Thank you very much for your blessing. It's a privilege to be here. I never do this, but I'm going to do this today. I'm going to dedicate my time with you this morning to the memory and in the memory of Matt Sanchez, one of the great human beings ever to walk this earth, for his spirit that is with us. I want to thank my friends from Los Prietos for being here today. It's an honor to have you here with us. Jim Buckley, who I taught 35, 40, I don't know how many years ago at Loyola High School. Barking to the Choir is my next book, but I don't recommend that this is how you should write a book. You know, start with a title and work backwards. So I'm talking to a homie one day, and I thought he was a guy who was sort of going off the rails a little bit, and I was trying to get him correct his driving to get out of going into oncoming traffic. And he was just showing up late and missing and in need, according to his supervisors in the bakery, in need of an emergency attitude ectomy, you know. So I'm running it down to him and giving him Gletscha, and he stops me. He goes, "You're barking to the choir." And I remember I immediately said, note to self, this will be the title of my next book. I don't have a book. I just have a title. But I love the combo burger nature of, barking up the wrong tree and preaching to the choir. So pray that I'll get a book that matches whatever that title means. So. Anyway, here's, I think, how this is going to go. I'm going to yak until we can't take it anymore, like about 11, and we'll have a break, and there's some grub out there. And then we'll come back, and then I'll just open it up and to have a conversation with you. So I always apologize these days because I can go to a place in the country and a little small town, a place I've never been in my life, and I'll think, great, nobody's ever heard me before. And then, you know, people say, oh, I heard that story, I like that story, or whatever. And I go, wow, in the hell? And so it's usually YouTube is the bane of my existence and TED Talks and that kind of thing. So I apologize if you've ever heard me before. You know, it happens. I've been to Santa Barbara lots of times. So once I was at a foster grandparent gathering, a huge gathering in Southern California, and I had spoken at the same event the summer before. For some reason, they invited me two summers in a row. And, oh, well, there I was giving the talk. And afterwards, a grandmother came up to me, and I think she liked the talk. She had big tears in her eyes, and she grabbed both my hands, and she said, "I heard you last year." It never gets better. So kind of hoping she misspoke there, but I'm not entirely sure. So anyway, thanks for your attention to coming out on a Thursday morning. Folks on the margins are just always hoping for a little bit of notice, you know. That's all people want, really. I had a very earnest 16-year-old gang member stand in front of my desk one day, and he said, "Look, I need your divided attention." I said, "You are so in luck because that's exactly what you'll be getting." So it's a vision that brings you to this gathering, and not just this morning, but to all the times you gather. It's a vision of, in the end, wanting the world to look differently than it currently looks, and good for you. The prophet Habakkuk writes, "The vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and it will not disappoint. And if it delays, wait for it." But nobody wants to wait for too long, con los brazos cruzados, you know, tapping your feet, staring at your watches. All of us want to make something happen. And so what is that we want to create? I want to suggest to you this morning, in the brief time I have with you, is that what we want to do is create a community of kinship such that God, in fact, might recognize it. Mother Teresa diagnosed the world's ills, of course, correctly, I think, when she suggested that the problem in the world is that we've just forgotten that we belong to each other. So how do we stand against forgetting that? How do we imagine with God a circle of compassion? And then imagine that no one is standing outside that circle. How do we together dismantle the barriers that exclude? Well, part of our strategy, of course, is to inch our way out to the very edges, to the margins. And here's the trick with the margins. If you stand at them, look under your feet. They're being erased merely by the fact and the act of you standing there. And so you choose to stand in your own way, in your own particularity, with the poor and the powerless and the voiceless. You stand with those whose dignity has been denied and those whose burdens are more than they can bear. Every once in a while, you get this amazing, privileged moment to be able to stand with the easily despised and the readily left out, with the demonized, so that the demonizing will stop, and with the disposable, so that the day will come when we stop throwing people away. Matt Sanchez did that with his life here in this city. And I suspect that if kinship was in fact our goal, we would no longer be promoting justice, we would be celebrating it. So, for 30 years I've worked with gang members, and I just feel like I'm the most privileged human being on the planet to have come to know some of the most courageous and noble and folks closest to God, and they've taught me everything of value. But in the last couple of years, they've taught me how to text, and so I'm I am so eternally grateful to them, because I find that it sure beats the heck out of actually talking to people. And so I'm pretty good at it, pretty dexterous, you know, LOL and OMG and BTW. And the homies have taught me a new one, OHN, which apparently stands for, oh, hell no. And I've been using that one quite a bit lately. So there I am in a car with two older vatos, Manuel and Poncho, and the two of them have been to prison tattooed. They do a variety of things for me. They're going to help me give a talk in Palm Desert at a high school. And so we have morning meeting every morning at 10 minutes to 9, where we give announcements and somebody gives a thought for the day. And so then meet in my car at 9 to make this trek to Palm Desert. So Manuel's in shotgun, so he's up front. And we're about 15 minutes on the road when Manuel gets an incoming, a text, and he reads it to himself, and he chuckles. And I say, well, what is it? Oh, it's dumb. It's from Snoopy back at the office. Well, I just seen Snoopy. Snoopy gave me a big abrazote as the day was beginning. Snoopy and Manuel work in our clock-in room, where they clock in hundreds and hundreds of our workers. We've got about 400 of them there. And it's a tough job, actually, to clock in all these people. Talk about attitudes sometimes, you know. And so I said, well, what's he say? Oh, it's dumb. Hang on. Hey, dog, it's me, Snoops. Yeah, they got my ass locked up at county jail. They're charging me with being the ugliest vato in America. You have to come down right now. Show them they got the wrong guy. Well, the three of us, we just died laughing, you know. And then I realized that Manuel and Snoopy are enemies. They are from rival gangs. They used to shoot bullets at each other. Now they shoot text messages. And there's a word for that, and the word is kinship. How do we obliterate once and for all the illusion that we are separate? No us and them, just us. Not good people, bad people, God's people. How do we do that? How do we pull that off? Because in the end, no kinship, no peace. No kinship, no justice. It really doesn't matter how singularly focused you may well be on peace and justice. It can't happen unless there's an undergirding sense of kinship, that we belong to each other, that there is a connection. Otherwise, it won't work. And, you know, service is obviously part of the air we breathe. All our kids who go to high school, even university, there's service learning, there's community service, there's... And service is great. But service is the beginning. Service is the hallway that gets you to the ballroom, which is the place of connection and mutuality and kinship. That's where you want to be. You want to bridge any distance that there might remain and exist between you. So at Homeboy Industries, we try to bridge that idea of I'm the service provider, you are the service recipient, you know. At Homeboy Industries, I'm not the great healer, and that gang member over there is in need of my exquisite healing. The truth is, we're all in need of healing. We're all a cry for help. It's one of the things that joins us together as human beings. One of the great privileges of my life was knowing Cesar Chavez as a friend. And he was an extraordinary man in all the ways that people know this to be true. But he was one of the best listeners I've ever met in my life. When you were talking to Cesar Chavez, nobody existed in the world but you. I wish I could pull that off. But once a reporter was commenting to him, he said, "Wow, these farm workers, they sure love you." And Cesar just shrugged and smiled and said, "The feeling's mutual." Which, of course, is the whole point. How do we arrive at that mutuality that is indeed exquisite, where there is no daylight that separates us? And no homie ever found more job opportunities through Homeboy Industries than this guy everybody called Dreamer. And I knew Dreamer since he was a mocosito growing up in the housing projects when I was pastor. Knew his whole family. And he got into a gang and got into trouble. And a very smart kid, actually brilliant, with a very quick wit and a dangerous sense of humor. He never kind of went to school, but he was... He probably would have gotten a PhD if he ever did. But there was a period in his life, in his early 20s, where I'd find him a jale or a job or an opportunity, either out in the community, in the private sector, or with us in one of our businesses. But he'd always sort of gravitate slowly back to vague criminality, you know, things involving drugs, usually, the sale of or the use of. And then he'd wander back to me. So he was kind of a yo-yo for this early 20s of his life. And so this one time he finished a four-month stretch, probation violation, county jail, and there he is sitting in front of me. And he says what gang members often say, "This time it'll be different." I go, all right. So with him sitting there, I picked up the phone. I call a friend of mine who runs a vending machine company in Alhambra, California. And this guy had hired homies in the past. I thought, well, maybe as changuitos, he'll do it again, you know. So, and he does. He says, "Yeah, tell him he can start tomorrow." That's a holy man right there. So Dreamer began working at the vending machine company. And 2 weeks later, there he is sitting again in front of my desk. Oh, híjole madre santa, I can't even believe this. But this time he pulls out of his pocket his very first paycheck and he says, "Damn, gee, this paycheck makes me feel proper. I mean, my jefita, she's proud of me, and my morritos, they're not ashamed of me. And you know who I have to thank for this job." And I said, "Well, just..." "Who?" And he looked at me strangely, and he said, "Well, God, of course." "Oh, yeah! No, that's right. No, that would be God, yeah." He said, "You thought I was going to say you." I said, "No, gosh. God's number one, yeah." He said, "You are so lucky. We're not living in them Genesis days." I'm sorry, them Genesis days? He goes, "Yeah, because God would have been had struck down your ass already by now," he said. Well, I guess he told me, but we just dissolved in laughter and fell out of our chairs. We were just howling. And I defy you to identify exactly who's the service provider, who's the service recipient. I have no idea. It's mutual. So Homeboy Industries was born, as was mentioned, and the kind introduction. During the time that I was pastor of the poorest parish in the city of Los Angeles, nestled in the middle of two public housing projects, Pico Gardens and Aliso Village. At the time, they comprised the largest grouping of public housing west of the Mississippi. So we had eight gangs occupying that territory, all at war with each other, leading the LAPD to call it the place of the highest concentration of gang activity in the whole city was my parish. I didn't know this when I arrived. So I buried my first young person killed because of this sadness in 1988, and I buried my 193rd human being about 3 months ago. And so we started to do things, you know, and you start to listen, you start to pay attention, you start to ask questions. So I noticed that there were so many middle school, junior high age gang members who had been given the boot from their home school. Nobody wanted them. And so they were in the projects all day long and wreaking havoc and violent and writing on the walls and selling drugs. So I went out to each one of them and I said, hey, if I found a school that would take you, would you go? Every single one of them, to my surprise, said, yeah, I would. And then I couldn't find a school that would take them. So that kind of forced my hand. So I went to the convent, which in those days was on the third floor of our parochial school. So the first two floors were the school. The whole third floor was the convent. And so I gathered all the nuns in the living room and I said, look, would you guys mind, you know, moving out? And and we could turn the convent into a school for gang members, you know. And they went, sure, you know. But where would we be without nuns? I have no idea. Yes, the clap. So they weren't homeless. We found a house for them in the community. And then so the gang members came to the church in large number. So that kind of upset the apple cart a little bit because aren't churches supposed to be hermetically sealed, you know? Good people in, and the bad people are out, you know, and so that was a good, what I might call a gospel challenge. And so the gang members, once they came to our school in such large numbers, they said, if only we had jobs. So myself and the women in the parish, we marched around the factories that surrounded the projects trying to find felony-friendly employers. So that wasn't so forthcoming. So we did a lot of things. We invented little work things, you know, neighborhood cleanup crews where we raised money and paid them, graffiti removal, light landscaping. The homies built a child care center. And then the unrest of 92 happened the last day of April after the Rodney King verdict. And so people were always hovering around the projects and reporters. And so they did an article. And Ray Stark read the article and summoned me. And long story short, he ended up buying this old abandoned bakery across the street from the church. We called it Homeboy Bakery. A month later, we started Homeboy Tortillas in the Grand Central Market in downtown L.A. Once we had plural, we came up with the highfalutin Homeboy Industries, as if there was any industry involved in this venture. Not everything worked. I will really be the first one to admit it. Homeboy Plumbing was not hugely successful. Who knew? People didn't want gang members in their homes. I did not see that coming. And nobody ever intends to do any of this, trust me. So we just backed our way into becoming the largest gang intervention, rehab, and reentry program in the world. No place on the planet engages more gang members in purposeful activity, gainful employment, positive regard, and hopeful waiting. So 15,000 folks walk through our doors every year. Keep in mind there are 1,100 gangs in L.A. County and 120,000 gang members. So you name anything that might be helpful for them, and we do it. We offer about 62 different curricular offerings, from anger management to grief and loss to parenting, GED. We still have a school with 115 gang member probationers. We have everybody's in therapy. We have 5 paid therapists, and we have 47 volunteer therapists. in a program we call Homeboy Heals. Free tattoo removal. No place on the planet Earth removes tattoos. In fact, we get folks from Santa Barbara who come and from as far as Vegas, and because the treatments are every 6 weeks, you can do that. We have a designated clinic. If anybody has ever been there, you can get a tour of all the place. They'll give you goggles. You can watch it happening. One paid physician assistant, about 36 volunteer doctors. 46,000 laser treatments a year. And it all started because of a guy named Frank, who I'd never met him. He wandered into my office straight out of Corcoran prison. 2 days out of prison, he's sitting there in front of my desk, and he tattooed on his forehead like a billboard, filling the entire space, and pardon my French, it says, "Fuck the world." Fills the whole damn space. And he says, "You know, I am having a hard time finding a job." I said, "Well, Frank, maybe we could put our heads together on this one, you know. As long as you're seeking employment in the world, you may have a problem with that." So I think, where do I send them? You know, to McDonald's? You know, do you want fries with that? So I hired him, of course, and he bagged bread for like 2 years at Homeboy Bakery, and then I went to search for a doctor. I went to White Memorial Hospital, where this dermatologist gave me 1 hour a month to chip away on Frank's forehead and a few others. And before too long, I had a waiting list of 3,000 gang members who wanted this treatment. I've never once said to somebody, "Remove your tattoos." You know, they've told me in large numbers. So now we have the program we have. And we owe it all to Frank, who is now a security guard at a movie studio, proving once and for all that all of us are a whole lot more than the worst things we've ever done or the dumbest things we've ever done. And so we have all our training programs, solar panel installation training program. We have all our businesses. Homeboy Bakery is thriving. Homeboy Diner, it's the only place you can buy food at City Hall. We just opened a restaurant. It'd be a year in February. At the LAX American Airlines Terminal. We're in like 30 farmers markets in the whole of the county of Los Angeles. What else am I missing? Homeboy Homegirls, Homeboy Silkscreen Factory. Homeboy Homegirl Merchandise, where we sell our products online, our logo stuff. We have our chips and salsas and all the Ralphs. Do you have Ralphs up here? Do you have chips and salsa? There you go. Buy them. Leave no salsa behind. And Homegirl Cafe, where women with records, young ladies from rival gangs, waitresses with attitude will gladly take your order. Some years ago, Diane Keaton showed up for lunch, Oscar-winning actress of Annie Hall fame and all the Godfather movies, big movie star. She shows up for lunch with a regular, a guy who's been there, who comes to lunch once a week. So he brings Diane Keaton one day, and her waitress is Glinda, and Glinda's a homegirl, been there, done that, tattooed, gang member, felon, been to prison. She does not know who Diane Keaton is, so she's taking her order. And Diane Keaton says, "Well, what do you recommend?" And Glinda rattles off the three platillos that she particularly likes, and Diane Keaton says, "Oh, I'll have that second one. That one sounds good." And it's at that moment, for some reason, something dawns on Glinda. She looks at Diane Keaton. She says, "Wait a minute. I feel like I know you from somewhere, that maybe we've met." And Diane Keaton decides to deflect it humbly. "Oh, gosh, I suppose, I don't know, I suppose I have one of those faces, you know, that people think they've seen before." And then Glinda goes, "No, now I know. We were locked up together." Yeah, that just took my breath away when I heard it. And I don't believe we've had any further Diane Keaton sightings now that I think of it. suddenly, kinship so quickly. Oscar-winning actress, attitudinal waitress, exactly what God had in mind. And what is on God's mind? I think that's a good question to ask. Well, we need go no further than to Jesus, who says that you may be one. In the end, I suppose he could have been more self-referential, but it's about us, that you may be one. It's about our kinship. It's about our connection. It's about our seeking this exquisite mutuality. All of us are called to be what Alice Miller, the late great child psychologist, called enlightened witnesses, people who through your kindness and tenderness and focused, attentive love return people to themselves. You don't hold the bar up and ask anybody to measure up. You just show up and you hold the mirror up and you tell people the truth, knowing that your truth is my truth and my truth is a gang member's truth. And it all happens to be the same truth. And here's the truth. You are exactly what God had in mind when God made you. And then you watch folks on the margins as they become that truth, as they inhabit that truth. And no bullet can pierce it. No four prison walls can keep it out. And death can't touch it. Because it's huge. But you have to reach in occasionally and dismantle the messages of shame and disgrace that get in the way, that keep folks from seeing their truth. Lately I've been taking a leisurely stroll through the Acts of the Apostles, and I suppose you could read it as a quaint snapshot of life in the early Christian community. Or you could read it as the measure of health in any community at all, including this one. Things will leap off the page for you. Things like, see how they love one another. That's a pretty good measurement. There's nobody needy in this community. That's an excellent metric. But my favorite one was this. And awe came upon everyone. It would seem that the measure of our health as a community may well reside in our ability to stand in awe at what the poor have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it. Some years ago, I was invited to Richmond, Virginia, to give an all-day training, 9 to 3, a kind of an in-service on gangs to 600 social workers. I was thinking, how am I going to fill 9 to 3? So I invited two homies with me to help me share the wealth. And so I invited Andre, African-American gang member who at the time worked in our retail store, and Jose, Latino gang member who in his mid-20s who had worked his way up from our janitorial crew into becoming a very valued member of our substance abuse team, a man thoroughly, solidly in his own recovery. But he also had a stretch of time as a homeless man on Skid Row and an even longer stretch as a heroin addict, and now he was helping youngsters struggle with their own addiction. So I told the two of them, get up and tell your stories. Take your time. So Jose got up, and I never heard either of their stories, and Jose began in sort of an offhanded way. He said, yeah, I guess you could say my mom and me, we didn't get along so good. I think I was six when my mom looked at me and said, why don't you just kill yourself? You're such a burden to me. Well, the whole audience did what you did, you know. And then he said, it sounds way worser in Spanish. And then everybody laughed, you know. He said, I guess I was 9 when my mom drove me down to the deepest part of Baja California and she walks me up to an orphanage. She knocks on the door, and when the guy answers, she says, I found this kid. And she left me there for 90 days. until my grandmother could get out of her where she had dumped me. My grandmother came and rescued me. My mom beat me every single day of my elementary school years with things you could imagine, a lot of things you couldn't. Every day, my back was bloodied and scarred. In fact, I had to wear 3 t-shirts to school every day. The first t-shirt, because the blood would seep through. And the second t-shirt, you could still see the blood. Finally, the 3rd t-shirt, you couldn't see any blood. Kids at school, they make fun of me. Hey, fool, it's 100 degrees. Why are you wearing 3 t-shirts? And then he stopped speaking, clearly overwhelmed with emotion. And he seemed to be staring at a piece of his story that only he could see. And when he could speak, he said through his tears, I wore 3 t-shirts well into my adult years because I was ashamed of my wounds. I didn't want anybody to see them. And now I welcome my wounds. I run my fingers over my scars. My wounds are my friends. After all, how can I help heal the wounded if I don't welcome my own wounds? And awe came upon everyone. The measure of our compassion lies not in our service of those on the margins, but in our willingness to see ourselves in kinship with them. For there's an idea that's taken root in the world. It's at the root of all that's wrong with it. And the idea would be this: that there just might be lives out there that matter less than other lives. We stand against that idea. All of us. Nobody in this room has ever met a hopeful kid who joined a gang. That's never happened. Equally, nobody in this room has ever met a good, healthy treatment plan worth a damn that was born of a bad diagnosis. I think that's never happened in the history of the world. I don't think that's possible. So a lot of you know, if you've read the book, that I struggle occasionally with leukemia. And I'm doing relatively okay. Or as the homies still say, I hear your cancer's in intermission. I said, yes. Apparently it stepped out to the lobby to buy popcorn. May the line be long, you know. But this summer I had to go back into some treatments for kind of a vexing lymphoma that appeared. And then I had to do it again before Thanksgiving. So a homie called me from jail, collect. And he said, hey, G, I hear you're back in treatments. I said, yeah. You got to be honest with me. I said, okay. Are you dying? No, I'm not dying. That's what I told this guy. I said, G has cancer, but he was getting that shit fixed, he said, you know. And I said, slow down with the medical jargon there, because I... Hard for me to keep up. But a diagnosis is so important. You know, if there's a bad diagnosis out there, it's not neutral. It puts you behind the eight ball. You lose time. It wastes valuable moments. So I went to give blood. I used to always give blood. And some guy taking my blood went, yikes, go see a doctor. So I went to see this doctor who I don't go to anymore. And he said I had mononucleosis, and so he, treated me for mono for, a whole year. And so I think we can all agree that there might be a difference, between mono and leukemia. So I had to get rushed into chemotherapy because of the bad diagnosis. And so I think it's important to get this stuff right, So there I am on the Dr. Phil show. I know, what was I thinking, you know, but we thought we had talked the producers down from doing something dumb, and so there I am backstage, and I can hear Dr. Phil introduce me. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the founder and executive director of Homeboy Industries, Father Greg Boyle. So I walk out there, and it's kind of bleachers, you know, it's kind of a live audience, but it's a tape show, and they're all clapping, and to my horror, there's Phil's sitting in a stool in the middle of the stage. Next to him, awaiting me, is my empty stool. But on his side of the stage is a gorgeous mahogany coffin on those four-wheel gurney things. On my side of the stage is a perfectly reconstructed jail cell with bed and sink and bars and toilet. I mean, they went to great expense for these two set pieces. And so we already know where this is going to go. You know, they fly in three unsuspecting young guys, males, 14, 15, 16 years old, African-American, Latino, and a white kid, from different parts of the country, flying them in to Hollywood with their single mothers who are extremely distraught because these kids are kind of gravitating perilously close to gang involvement. So, with each successive kid, they'd come out and Phil would kind of grab them figuratively by the lapel, you know, and say, "Don't you see where this choice is leading you?" That was a good Phil, wasn't it? I think I sort of accomplished it. And he would point to the two set pieces. Finally, by the third kid, I said, "Phil, how do I break this to you? These kids don't lack information. They're not in search of data. They know that this will lead to death or to prison. They don't care that it will." And that's the key diagnostic moment. Because gangs are the places kids go when they've encountered their life as a misery. And who doesn't know by now that misery loves company? No kid is seeking anything when he joins a gang. Like Jose, they're always fleeing something, always, no exceptions. And, you know, if a kid can't imagine a future for himself, then his present isn't very compelling. And if your present doesn't compel you, then you will not care whether you inflict harm. And you won't care whether you duck to get out of harm's way. The three profiles of kids who join gangs are the despondent, the ones who can't conjure up an image of tomorrow, the hugely traumatized and damaged kid who can't see his way clear to transform his pain, so he just keeps transmitting it. And the third profile is the mentally ill kid, all on a continuum of severity. And sometimes it's a combo burger of one and three or two and one. And if we knew that diagnosis was in fact true, we'd infuse hope to kids for whom hope is foreign. We'd help heal the damaged and the traumatized, and we'd deliver mental health services in a timely and culturally appropriate way. Parentheses. I'm in like 23 different detention facilities. People always say, "Where's your church?" Well, that's my church. All these jails, probation camps, as we have in LA County, juvenile halls. And I say mass there. So I'm in this saying mass in a kind of a gym at a place called Camp Mendenhall. And about 100 gang members in this thing. So I have my table set up and I'm all vested. And after mass, you know, they all come up and crowd around and ask questions. And I'm endlessly handing out my card, you know. I once had a kid say, "Hey, how do I get your credit card?" Jack my wallet, I guess. I'm sorry. I was misunderstanding you. But we were standing there, and I'm doing the dishes, you know, and some guy over here says, "Hey, I saw you on Oprah." "Well, no, actually it was Dr. Phil." "Oh," I said, "yeah, I have a hard time telling those two apart myself." Then this guy over here says, "You were on Dr. Phil? Fighting with your wife?" Well, these guys over here died laughing, and he's kind of what's so funny, you know. And I said, yeah, you know, but Phil gave me really good advice, and the two of us are doing so much better, you know. I'll tell her you were asking for her. All right, we're going to need a break. So let me just finish one story. You know, people always ask me, so get your questions prepared. You know, people ask me about enemies working side by side with each other, and it's probably dicey to begin with initially. A homie will come and say, I'm ready, ready, ready. And our program is not for those who need help. Lots of folks do. It's only for those who want help. So a homie comes in and he says he's ready. And I say, okay, I have an opening in the bakery. But you have to work with X, Y, and Z. And I rattle off the names of enemies, rivals. And they think about it for a long ass time. And then they say, all right, I'll work with them, but I'm not going to talk to them. Which used to bother me in the old days, but until you discover, of course, that it's impossible for human beings to demonize people they know. You really can't. Nobody can pull that off. Humans can't sustain that, fortunately. So I had this homie, little chaparrito, short kid, everybody called youngster, who I thought was ready. I don't really use gang placas, you know, except if they're benign, youngster, or flaco, lefty, you know. I don't say sniper. I don't say psycho, you know. I had a big, huge guy come right out of prison. It was in my office. Say, hey, what do your homies call you? Fluffy. I said, I am trembling in my boots, dog. So I had youngster, and youngster I thought was ready. And so I bring him to Homeboy Silkscreen, which is our largest business. Been around for about 18 years. 2,500 customers from all over the country. High quality work, reasonably priced. We UPS to Santa Barbara. So I bring youngster in there, and we have thousands of gang members have worked there over the last almost two decades. So I'm introducing him to his coworkers, and I watch as he shakes hands with all these guys. Firm handshake, look them in the eye. Even enemies, lots of rivals. And I think to myself, wow, that's great. Until he gets around to the very last guy, the guy who seems to be wanting to avoid this encounter altogether, a kid everybody called Puppet. And so when Puppet and the youngster are in each other's vicinity, they mumble something. They stare at their shoes. They don't shake hands. Well, you know, I know they're enemies because I know what gangs they're from, but he just finished shaking hands with other enemies. I discover later that this is a hatred that's really quite deep, very personal, beyond which neither of them think they can get past, really. So I sense that much at the moment. I said, hey, look, if you guys can't hang working together, let me know. I got a gang of people who want this job. Calladitos, they don't say a word. Well, cut to about 6 months later, a Puppet leaves his house to walk to a store some distance from his home. One of those little corner stores, and he purchases something. On the way home, for some reason, he decides to take a shortcut. So he dodges into an alley. And because he's taken this detour suddenly, unexpectedly, he's surrounded by 10 members of a rival gang. 10 against 1. And they beat him badly. And he falls to the ground. And they will not stop kicking his head until he's lifeless. Somebody finds his body and takes him to White Memorial Hospital, where he's declared effectively brain dead. But it's the policy at the hospital to keep you connected to machines for 48 hours so the doctors can get 2 full days of a flat read with no brain activity and enabling them to sign the death certificate, making it official. This allowed family and friends to gather. I was at St. Louis University giving a talk. I flew home immediately. I've seen a lot of horrible things in my life, but nothing to compare to the sight of this young man with his head swollen many times its size. It was horrifying. You could barely train your eyes on him. So at the end of the 48-hour period, I say a blessing over him. I anoint his forehead with oil. con la unción de los enfermos. We disconnect. And a week later, I buried him. But in the first 24 hours, while Puppet is lying beaten in the hospital, I'm alone in my office. It's 8:30 at night. The phone rings. And it's Youngster, Puppet's co-worker from the silkscreen factory. "Hey," he says, "that's messed up about what happened to Puppet." I said, "Yeah, it is." And then with a certain kind of eagerness even, he said, "Is there anything I can do? Can I give him my blood?" And we both fall silent under the weight of it. Until finally, he breaks the silence, choking back his tears. And he says with great deliberation, "He was not my enemy. He was my friend. We worked together." Now, can I say that always happens at Homeboy Industries? Yes, of course. Any exceptions? Not a single one. And it shouldn't surprise us that God's own dream come true for us, that we be one. Just happens to be our own deepest longing for ourselves. For it turns out, it's mutual. For the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and it will not disappoint. And if it delays, we wait for it. See you at 11:15.